Syria's rebels on the verge of defeat in Homs. Today, Tuesday, April 22nd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Syria's government looks set to take the besieged city of Homs back from rebels. And amid the fierce fighting, some in Homs are actually taking time to put up banners, urging people to vote for President Assad in elections scheduled for June.
I saw one that read, "Hand in hand, we're going to rebuild Syria with you, Bashar al-Assad."
Also on the program, some say Britain isn't wild enough, so why not reintroduce wild beavers there? We hear the pros and cons coming up. Plus, speaking of introductions, 50 years ago, Americans got their first taste of Belgian waffles at the World's Fair in Queens.
People start tasting our waffle, they just couldn't believe it. From the time of opening at 10 o'clock, we never saw the end of the line.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Vice President Joe Biden says it's time for Russia to stop talking and start acting to defuse the crisis in Ukraine. Biden made the statement in Kiev, where he's visiting to demonstrate American support for the interim Ukrainian government. The U.S. wants Russia to do more to implement the so-called Geneva Accord, which calls for pro-Russian militants to leave government buildings they're occupying in eastern Ukraine. That is not happening, as I heard today from the BBC's Natalia Antalava, who's in the eastern city of Donetsk.
At the moment, we have at least 11 cities where main administrative buildings have been occupied and remain occupied by protesters, pro-Russian demonstrators and militants.
So 11 cities where municipal buildings are being occupied by pro-Russia forces. I mean, that's more than a few days ago, isn't it?
More than a few days ago, and there's absolutely no sign of anybody leaving. In fact, more buildings are being occupied, not today, but yesterday we had a few more buildings were taken over. One of the clauses of the Geneva Agreement is that the protesters must leave all the occupied buildings. But the ones that we're speaking to are saying that they have absolutely no plans to leave until the government in Kiev leaves, because as far as they are concerned, they say the government in Kiev is also occupying the government buildings there illegally. So it's a bit of a deadlock.
What does that refusal to back down suggest to you?
Well, the refusal to back down certainly suggests that, you know, everyone that we're talking to is saying that they're willing to go to the end. There are people who are saying they want to go the way that Crimea went and be annexed and join Russia. It's not all black and white, though. I think one thing that's quite interesting is that some of the pro-Russian activists that I've been talking to are feeling anxious and are questioning how much support will they actually get from Moscow. Mm. And it's interesting because you get the same sense from the pro-Kiev side as well, with supporters of the United Ukraine saying that they're not getting as much support from the West as they would like to have.
Oh, interesting. I'm curious, too, what people in the East make of people in Kiev, especially those still camped out in the Maidan. I mean, they're the ones who support the interim government, the government the Ukrainians in the East say is illegal.
You know, that's one of the most extraordinary things about being here and talking to these people is the perception of the other side that they have. I mean, a lot of people that I talk to actually genuinely believe that Kiev is full of neo-Nazi fascist forces who are waiting to break into eastern Ukraine and take over. I mean, that's the sense you get. At pro-Russian rallies, you speak to people who, you know, hate the United States and Europe, and it's genuine hatred.
How real, then, is the threat of war in the area?
That's a question for President Putin, if you ask me. Mm. He's the one who will ultimately decide, because from everything that we've seen, the Ukrainian army is not going to do very much on the ground. They can't. They don't have much of a control over anything here. We saw some of the Ukrainian troops that are stationed along the border, and I kept pressing the commander on camera, off camera. I kept asking him, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Basically, the sense you get from them is that they will do what they have done already. They will will turn around and leave. They're not going to fight. The Ukrainian military is in a terrible state. This will be a war that they will lose if they fight it. So it is very much up to Russia and up to President Putin what happens next here. From what I'm seeing, it's very unlikely that local pro-Russian militants here will pick a serious fight unless they feel real backing from Moscow.
Reporter Natalia Antalava in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another potential target for a Russian takeover in Ukraine is Odessa. Ukraine's third largest city is also the country's largest remaining port now that Crimea is under Russian control. And if pro-Russian protesters can take control of Odessa, it could effectively cut Ukraine in two. The Self-Defense of Odessa is the title of an article in Foreign Policy magazine by contributing editor Christian Carroll. So you've recently been to Odessa, Christian. What is the evidence of a shift toward Russia there?
I think 6 months ago, none of the groups that I interviewed when I was in Odessa really existed in the same way. And now there are very clear pro-Ukraine, pro-Euromaidan groups which support the overthrow of President Yanukovych. And then there are also very clear pro-Russian groups who call themselves the anti-Maidan. And when you talk to those people, they aren't necessarily in favor of joining Russia, but you do hear them talking about this new word that President Putin used in his address the other day, Novorossiya, which is a word that was still used in the 19th century for southern and eastern Ukraine, that whole territory. So there's this idea that one might actually create a new state out of the Eastern Republics and the area surrounding Odessa that would, as you said in your introduction, effectively cut Ukraine in two.
Yeah. How do the people of Odessa feel about that?
What you hear from them is a litany of complaints about the government in Kiev. You know, Odessa is a magnificent city. It's all these glorious 19th century buildings. I really can't talk the architecture up enough, but it's all falling apart. You know, there really has not been much done in the 20 years since Ukraine became independent. And people have the whole usual list of complaints, you know, corruption, incompetence. For some Russian speakers, there are issues with language teaching in the schools. They don't feel that there's enough room for Russian. So you hear all these complaints and these grievances, and then people will say, but, you know, actually, I wouldn't want to become part of Russia. I'd still like to stay part of Ukraine because I don't want outsiders coming in here and telling us what to do. And that's actually supported by the poll figures, which suggest that something around 70-75% of Odessans actually would like Ukraine to stay as it is.
Now, the pro-Maidan groups, the Western-leaning faction, those are those self-defense units you write about in Foreign Policy. Describe them. I mean, who are these people who comprise these groups?
These are younger people. A lot of them are self-employed. They're people who support the idea of a democratic, independent Ukraine. This whole spectacle of the so-called little green men, these mysterious insurgents in camouflage, well-armed, well-trained, taking over key government buildings in eastern Ukraine has been quite a shock to these pro-Kiev people in Odessa, which they realize is a very, in some ways, vulnerable place. So what the pro-Maidan, the pro-revolutionary forces are talking about in Odessa now is putting in place a plan of action that would thwart that kind of takeover in Odessa. So even though these groups are very, very lightly armed, in fact, they don't really have any weapons to speak of, the idea is that they could at least try to thwart a takeover of local government buildings by a small number of well-organized, well-armed men so that these pro-Kiev, pro-independence people would be there in time, would gather at these places, which are, you know, key communications nodes, key government buildings, and basically just surround them and protect them so that when the pro-Russian insurgents show up, they won't be confronted by nothing. There will actually be people there defending these buildings, and then, you know, something would have to give in order for those men to take them over.
Well, I mean, that seems crazy. I mean, they've got a plan in place, but few guns. I mean, how can they even come close to matching the forces Russia has if they were to come rolling in?
If you have 100 relatively lightly armed people surrounding a government building in Odessa, they're basically daring those guys with weapons to push them aside by force to, like, basically open fire on them. And that will complicate things for the attempted occupiers of the building and give them enough time, give the pro-Ukrainian forces enough time to get the actual military, the actual police on the scene. You know, who knows if this will work? It seems like a bit of a Hail Mary pass.
It does. Christian Carroll, contributing editor for Foreign Policy, who's just returned from Odessa in Ukraine. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
The ancient city of Homs in Syria is known as the cradle of the revolution, the place where the revolt against President Bashar al-Assad got started back in 2011. It's been an opposition stronghold since then. Now Assad's government has launched an all-out assault on rebel positions in Homs, even as government supporters in the city are campaigning ahead of an election that's strangely scheduled for June. Most of the rebels left in Homs are with the al-Nusra Front, an al-Qaeda affiliate. Wall Street Journal correspondent Sam Dagger is in Homs, where he witnessed some of the fighting today.
I was in a part of Homs called Bab el-Sabah. It's a neighborhood that revolves around one of the gates of the old city. It's called the Lion's Gate in Arabic. And I was doing an interview in the morning, and all of a sudden, a fierce gun battle commenced, and then rockets started flying in both directions. And this was only like less than a mile away from where I was. And obviously, I had to hunker down for a few hours. And one of the rockets fired by the rebels crashed nearby. So it seemed really intense. And then obviously, there are civilians in this area, a lot of people who've been displaced from other parts of the city. And then once I was back at the hotel, I could still hear the airstrikes on rebel positions around that area where I was.
And out of that one kind of slice of violence in Homs, were you able to tell who had the upper hand at the end?
It seemed like they're really locked in a fierce battle now. The government is trying to flush them out. I mean, that's what they told me that they wanted to do, to get them out of the old quarter. So they said it's so difficult for them to go in because it's a warren of alleyways and it's old buildings and really kind of, if you imagine an ancient sort of Middle Eastern city in its historic center, so it's that kind of a place. It's hard for tanks to go in. It's hard for ground troops to go in. And that's what they told me. So they at this point, they're saying we'd like to flush them out. But again, the rebels are coming in, mounting these counteroffensive and going back in. So security officials keep telling us, this will be over by the end of this week. But it seems like they're really facing some stiff resistance because the Islamist-led rebels inside the old quarter were able to mount this counteroffensive. And that was pretty big deal. And I was actually this morning close to that area that was attacked on Saturday, where the checkpoint was attacked. And, it was a full-on battle. I could hear, the heavy machine guns, rockets being fired on both sides, mortars. So it's a pretty full-on battle that was still going on today.
Have you seen any evidence, Sam, that rebels are in fact surrendering?
That's a good question, because we've had up to now almost 600 fighters and let's call them military age men, about 600, according to figures that were given to me by a lieutenant in the Syrian army yesterday. And this is also confirmed by what residents and even the opposition activists themselves are saying, that people have been surrendering. But it seems like there are a couple of hardcore groups in there, particularly like the Nusra Front and some of the more sort of Islamist factions that are determined to make a last stand.
Can you imagine an election happening in about 6 weeks in Homs, really anywhere in Syria?
To the outside world, it sounds unimaginable, but the government does control most of Homs, with the exception of these two areas. And, I'm seeing preparations here in this city. I mean, I was walking around today, and I saw people in a predominantly Sunni neighborhood. Now, as you know, most of the fighters are Sunnis, and there were people putting up election banners. I saw one that read, hand in hand, we're going to rebuild Syria with you, Bashar al-Assad. And they were putting it up. It was a big banner. So it seems like preparations are underway. In Damascus, they control the whole city pretty much, with the exception of the suburbs that are around the city. Aleppo, I was recently in Aleppo. They control like the west side of the city, so they can hold elections there. They're saying we're going to hold elections wherever we have control.
Sam Dagger, a correspondent with the Wall Street Journal, speaking with us from Homs, Syria. Sam, thank you for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Still to come, a tale of two stone throwers, one Palestinian, one Israeli, and why they're treated so differently on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon. And by TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo, bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When you're an environmental activist, Every day is Earth Day, not just April 22nd. And in many places around the globe, being an environmental activist can literally mean putting your life on the line. In fact, between 2002 and 2013, more than 900 environmental and land rights activists were killed around the world. That's the conclusion of a new report by the watchdog group Global Witness. Oliver Courtney is one of the report's co-authors. That's a pretty big number of murders. And we are talking murders here, right? Not accidental deaths.
Exactly. We are talking people who've been killed in the line of protecting their rights to land and the environment.
As these numbers started coming in, and as you did your research, were you actually shocked to see how many people had been killed in the line of this duty?
The numbers have been shocking. This piece of research actually grew out of a growing concern within our organization, Global Witness, on the back of the killing of a colleague and friend of ours investigating illegal logging in Cambodia. And there was a growing sense that actually this was happening more and more often and that not enough was being done to monitor it or to do something about it. I think the numbers are shocking. I think what's perhaps even more shocking is that all the signs point to there being a vast number of cases which are going unmonitored and unrecognized.
What kinds of situations do activists find themselves in that someone wants them eliminated?
Well, two-thirds of the cases that we've documented, you can track back to contest over who has the right to land and certainly whether or not the people who've been living on that land for generations can really assert their rights. Now, often these are some of the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world, and they really are often very faced with very little choice but to defend those rights.
I was struck, Oliver, by the finding in your report that of the six worst places in the world to be an environmental activist, five are in Latin America: Brazil, Honduras, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico. Why?
One of the common themes seems to be the concentration of land in the hands of a few small, very powerful landowners. And you have a large chunk of the population which remains poor and is very much reliant on the land. And as I've said already, that dynamic sparks conflict.
How many of these cases are prosecuted?
1% of the cases that we have documented, there is a known killer who has been brought to justice.
How do you get these numbers to go down? I mean, what can the world do? What perhaps can we do as Americans now that we know this, other than just shake our heads and say, wow, that's really awful?
Well, the immediate responsibility definitely lies with governments. There's also a role for companies. The vast majority of the cases that we've uncovered have involved resistance to the operations of mining or logging or agribusiness companies. So those companies have a responsibility to make sure that they aren't involved with or sponsoring this kind of abuse. There is a role for consumers in that this problem is ultimately driven by consumption in the rich world. So that's something that we have to consider ourselves on a day-to-day basis and our governments have to legislate for.
Oliver Courtney is a co-author along with Alice Harrison of the new report, Deadly Environment, the Dramatic Rise in Killings of Environmental and Land Defenders, from the watchdog group Global Witness. Oliver, thanks very much for your time.
Many thanks.
Okay, there's also some good news to report on this Earth Day, particularly if you're a fan of beavers. Wild beavers can play an important part in local ecosystems, but in England, beavers were hunted to extinction hundreds of years ago. As of this winter, though, at least one family of beavers is back in the wild there. How they got there is still a mystery, as we hear in Christopher Worth's report from England.
That's the main river otter, just there.
Tom Buckley is an ecologist in the town of Ottery St. Mary in western England.
On an almost daily basis, I walk around this area.
We traipse through a muddy field just outside the parish, where late last year, Buckley noticed a few trees missing on the riverbank. Their stumps appeared to be gnawed to sharp points, and an absurd thought ran through his mind that what he saw was the work of a beaver.
I couldn't really believe that there'd be a beaver here in the River Otter. They've been extinct for several hundred years.
So Buckley installed motion sensor cameras, and his hunch was soon confirmed. A single European beaver caught on tape, then three, possibly one juvenile and a pair of adults, cutting down a tree and then happily embracing each other.
And they seem to have come to focus on this tree to look at the potential perhaps of a new home, and they seemed to be so happy in what they'd achieved here. It was marvellous to see, it really was.
The images made national headlines, and they turned Buckley into something of a celebrity among the townspeople.
They will point out and say, "Ah, are you the beaver man?" And it seems to me to be a great addition of an animal that man, due to his greed, once made extinct. It's a great achievement that they've managed to come back. but I'm very greatly distressed that the government may take a heavy hand and potentially take away these beavers.
There's been no official statement as of yet from wildlife authorities, but technically these beavers aren't supposed to be here. No one's sure where they came from, and nearby Wildlife Center says it hasn't lost any. But there has been a long, contentious debate in England over whether to reintroduce beavers, as has already happened in Scotland. One side says yay, the other says nay, and on the River Otter, it looks like someone may have just gone ahead and done it.
The whole of the island of Great Britain will be affected by this.
Nick Young is mostly in the nay camp. He's with the Tweed Foundation, an organization concerned about the impact beavers could have on migratory fish, such as salmon and sea trout. He recognizes the fish and beavers coexisted for tens of thousands of years, but he's not so sure how they'd coexist now.
The main thing that beavers do, and I think everybody knows this, is build dams. They have a huge effect on altering the environment. And the problem with these dams is that they're very effective blockers of fish passage.
Others worry about the loss of trees and flooding, a problem England has suffered a lot from lately.
That's just a crap argument.
That's Derek Gow, firmly in the yay faction. He's a conservationist who's campaigned for the reintroduction of beavers since the 1990s. And he says beaver dams would actually reduce flooding by holding water. He says fears about beavers arise from the fact that after centuries living without them, people have forgotten what the animals actually do.
They think it's some sort of Godzilla-type thing that's going to rip babies out of prams and, you know, kick down the Houses of Parliament and chop down every tree there is in the landscape. And that's all just ridiculous.
Gow himself keeps about 20 beavers here on his farm in large enclosed habitats about 50 miles from the River Otter. He uses them to show what he says are the animal's environmental benefits.
Can you hear the water running?
This is where we start to see some dams.
We walk down into a narrow stream bed where a pair of his captive beavers has transformed a simple water course into a series of small dams and pools of water.
So you can see just standing here, you get deep water, shallow water, fast water, slow water. There's a whole variety of different ecotopes, but it's all down to the beavers. And those wetlands are very good for a host of other species.
Like different types of fish and amphibians, Gow points to a shallow pool filled with clumps of tiny eggs.
That's frog spawn. That's spawn of common frogs.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, last year, that couldn't be here. There was no prospect of that surviving because there was one single water course and it would just blast all their eggs out. Now, of course, you've got this myriad of tiny pools and these amphibians can safely go in there, lay, and these will become tadpoles and they'll hatch and more amphibians will come every year. Without the beavers, none of this happens.
As for the wild beavers on the River Otter, Gow says it would have been nice if the species could have been officially reintroduced, but he says he didn't release the beavers and they shouldn't be removed just because someone didn't fill out the right paperwork. For The World, I'm Christopher Wirth, Devon, England.
It's not just beavers. Tomorrow, Christopher reports on efforts to reintroduce other long-lost species into Europe. That's on The World, and this is The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. For almost 40 years, a UN-mandated buffer zone has separated Greek and Turkish Cypriots.
When they put the buffer zone in, nobody could go back. All the houses in the buffer zone are still owned by people. The cars in the underground garage, which I went to, is still owned by people.
Photographing the places where time stands still in Cyprus, just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. We've all thrown a stone into a lake or skipped rocks at the beach. It's a harmless activity, but a stone can also become a weapon if it's thrown at a person or a moving vehicle. That's something Israelis and Palestinians are very familiar with, and it's young people who often do the throwing. Reporter Daniel Estrin spent months investigating the prosecution of young stone throwers in the West Bank for an article he co-wrote for the Associated Press. He focused on two cases, both 15-year-olds accused of throwing stones at vehicles, and he found they were treated differently under Israel's justice system in the West Bank.
Israeli and Palestinian youths who live in the same area, the West Bank, are accused of similar crimes. A very common crime is throwing stones at each other, but they're subject to two different sets of laws. Israeli settlers are prosecuted under Israeli civilian law, but Palestinians who live just a few minutes away from those Israeli settlers are subject to a completely different set of laws, the military laws and the military justice system.
Just sum up for us the different stories, the different outcomes of these two stone throwers and how they were treated differently when it came to prosecution, one Palestinian, the other Israeli.
So on February 20th, the Israeli boy who I met was arrested and accused of throwing stones at a bus because its driver was Arab. He was brought into the police station with his father. He invoked his right to remain silent. He spent a night at the police station, 4 days under house arrest, and then he was freed without charge. Only a few months later, when he was picked up on another crime, he was indicted for the rock throwing, and he was put under house arrest for 9 months. Then he was released, free to go, and it took nearly 2 years for his trial to begin, and that trial is still ongoing. So compare that to the story of the Palestinian boy who, the day after the Israeli boy was arrested for throwing stones, the Palestinian boy was accused of throwing rocks at Israeli cars going down the highway. He was arrested at 3:30 in the morning by Israeli soldiers, blindfolded, handcuffed, taken to the police station, and he was thrown in the military detention center for 9.5 months while his trial was ongoing. After 9.5 months, he was sent to house arrest for 7 months. And only then did his trial end. He was found guilty and he was freed. So when you look at the two boys, they were accused of the same crime, throwing stones, one day after the other. They lived just a couple minutes away from each other. But one was in jail for a very long time and under house arrest. And the other kid was under house arrest and then freed, and his trial is still ongoing.
Those experiences are borne out with the numbers. You find that 53 Israeli kids were arrested for stone throwing over a 6-year period. Over the same time, over 1,100 Palestinian kids, and with vastly different conviction rates. So this is a story of the street, Daniel. How big an issue is this for the public?
Well, stone throwing in Israel is a major issue. There are reports on the news all the time of Palestinians throwing stones at Israeli cars zipping down the highway. And stones can kill and injure, and they have killed and injured Israeli motorists. But also, this tactic of stone throwing has been adopted by particularly extremist Israeli settlers who also throw stones at Palestinians. Stone throwing has become almost a symbolic act. You know, in the West Bank, rocks are aplenty. It's a very rocky terrain, and all you have to do to fight someone is to bend down and pick up a rock. It's something that happens very frequently. Rock throwing may seem like sort of a kid's play, but Israeli security officials say these rocks can kill, and rock throwing is considered a very severe crime here.
Daniel, as you said, there is no shortage of rocks in the Mideast, and I got to say, that alone, there's something cruelly symbolic about that, and visceral, you know, just picking up a rock and throwing it. Is the peace process dealing with issues like this? I mean, this seems to be always so deep in the minutiae and not kind of dealing with these basic issues like throwing a rock at your neighbor.
You know, the peace process is dealing with the big issues, the status of Jerusalem, what will happen to Palestinian refugees. Day-to-day issues like stone throwing, they happen really very, very frequently. And this is really the sort of day-to-day battle going on between Palestinians and Israelis. I think it's something that, you know, that gets buried in the headlines of the peace process. But this is sort of the day-to-day friction and tension happening in the West Bank. And the way that the justice system deals with kids who pick up a stone and throw a stone, it affects where these kids go and what they become. And I think it's something that we have to pay a lot more attention to.
Daniel Estrin, who's authored a story for the Associated Press on prosecution rates for Israeli and Palestinian stone throwers. Thanks very much, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
There's another divide I want to tell you about, not too far geographically from Israel in the West Bank. This divide physically cuts through an island in the Mediterranean, and it's created an eerie space that not many people get to explore. Perfect material for the segment my colleague Clark Boyd produces every week for the show. We call it the Sideways Glance, a place, as Clark puts it, for the slightly off-kilter stories that make us do a double or even a triple take.
Photographer Neil Hall usually works out of Reuters' London office, but he'd been out to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus a few times to visit friends. Now, sure, for a photographer, there's plenty of sun, lots of nice touristy things to snap pictures of there. Hall, however, was drawn to something else. It's called the United Nations Buffer Zone.
It's pretty much, you know, a barrier between northern Cyprus and southern Cyprus. And, you know, there's checkpoints along the way. There's large signs that say no photography. And I think any photographer that works in journalism, you know, if they see a big sign that says no photography, well, that makes you want to find out more.
Okay, here's the find out more part. The UN buffer zone is a 112-mile strip that runs the entire length of Cyprus. It was formally established in 1974. That's when long simmering tensions between Greek and Turkish Cypriots erupted into violence. In July of 1974, Greek Cypriots staged a coup with an eye toward uniting the entire island with Greece. Turkey took exception to that, and 5 days later, Turkish forces invaded the northern part of the country. The fighting didn't last very long. The UN stepped in quickly, creating a buffer zone along the ceasefire line. According to Security Council Resolution 353, the zone is to be entered by no forces other than UN peacekeepers. Fast forward 40 years, and it's still there, still patrolled by UN peacekeepers. And, as photographer Neil Hall found out, off-limits to most Cypriots.
When they put the buffer zone in, nobody could go back. All the houses in the buffer zone are still owned by people. The cars in the underground garage, which I went to, is still owned by people. They're just not able to go in and collect them, unfortunately. And that was one thing I really wanted to focus on, the idea that the buffer zone itself could be seen as a time capsule.
Hall pitched the idea to his bosses at Reuters and convinced them to send him to Cyprus. He filled out all the requisite UN paperwork, along with the documents required by the respective authorities that run each side of the island. And then, with a UN escort, Hall went in and opened up that time capsule. He spent a day at Cyprus's international airport. A 70s-era jet still sits on the tarmac near the terminal, as if it's waiting for passengers to board.
In the airport in particular, that was somewhere which struck me as being something that, you know, you could be almost like a zombie movie. The airport departure land was full of pigeons and animals like that. And I believe in sort of the less populated areas of the buffer zone, it has become an almost unofficial wildlife sanctuary because so few people go there. Wildlife has been able to take over again.
Hall's photos show what are now vintage cars, covered in dust. There are advertising posters, soda bottles, stacks of old televisions straight out of the 1970s. But it's not all nostalgic fun in the buffer zone, especially in the capital, Nicosia.
Nicosia itself calls itself the last divided capital in the world.
Yep, the buffer zone runs right through it.
That was the borderline between where the two sides were fighting. So it's almost like a time capsule of guerrilla warfare. Houses had been sandbagged up and firing positions were put into windows. You would notice bullet holes everywhere.
In all, the buffer zone takes up more than 130 square miles of Cyprus. At some points, it's a few miles wide. In other parts, just a few feet. In 2003, the two sides agreed to open more checkpoints through the zone to allow Cypriots to travel back and forth between the north and south more easily. In one of Neil Hall's favorite shots, kids play on some swings in a playground. Behind them, you can see a UN guard tower and a fence topped with razor wire, demarcating the buffer zone.
That picture really said to me just how, you know, daily life still goes on in Cyprus, even though the country is divided and the island is in an extraordinary situation where it has this enormous tract of land that its inhabitants can't even go into. I think it's just a fact of life. Many people I spoke to said that they wish that the island could be united again, but they didn't know when that would occur.
To be fair, there are a few villages within the zone, and one, called Pyla, is billed as the only spot on the island where the original Greek and Turkish populations still live side by side. The UN's mandate in the zone remains the same as it's been for 40 years, working toward a return to normal conditions. Earlier this year, after an 18-month hiatus, reunification talks resumed between the Greek and Turkish sides. One thing's for sure, if Cyprus does reunite, there's a big stretch of land through the middle that's got about 40 years of catching up to do. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
Slightly Hitchcockian, Neil Hall's photos of the Cyprus buffer zone. They are pretty amazing. And that abandoned 1970s era airport lounge, Hitchcock himself would be pleased with the mess the birds made of the place. See the pics for yourself at PRI.org. Plus, find all of our Sideways Glance stories at PRI.org/Sideways Glance. Clark would love it if you stopped by and include him in on other places in the world that time seems to have forgotten. 50 years ago, in 1964, a few things happened that changed our country. Among them, the Beatles landed in America, Diet Pepsi was introduced, and on this day, 50 years ago, the 1964 World's Fair opened in Queens, New York. Marie-Paul Vermeersch remembers being at the fair with her mom and dad. They worked at the Belgium exhibit in a little Tudor-style house. And Ms. Vermeersch, tell us what you were doing 50 years ago.
We introduced the authentic Belgium waffle, called at the time Brussels waffle, which is a typical specialty of Brussels, this recipe we have. There's many different types of waffles in Belgium. And at the last moment, my parents, who had a little bit of time to observe American taste, my mother realized that there was, at the time, a little bit of ignorance still, and she told my father, it's not a good idea to call our waffle the Brussels waffle. I think some people will not be able to locate where the waffle comes from. So at the time, she told my father, let's call it La Gaufre Belge, which is Belgian waffles.
That house, that little Tudor house that was selling Brussels waffles, it said on the sign at the time, that was on the grounds of Flushing Meadows in Queens. Is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so,
and it was quite an experience.
Yeah, why was it such an experience?
Well, the American waffle, which has been, you know, known for a long time, the round, heavy, very doughy. When people start tasting our waffle, they just couldn't believe it, and they kept. I mean, we, from the time of opening at 10 o'clock, we would see endless. We never saw the end of the line. So people just couldn't believe how the waffle were light and crispy and fluffy. And actually, in Belgium, we had, in my mother's family, never served them with whipped creams and strawberries. This waffle is most often sprinkled with powdered sugar directly out of the iron. But again, my parents, observing the American people had a sweet tooth here, and they came up with the idea of fresh whipped cream and hand-cut strawberries. The strawberries were a big problem. How we were going to put strawberries that were sliced but not going to make a goop. My mother didn't want anything that would get the waffle soggy. So we had about a team of 10 people constantly slicing strawberries because, you know, when you serve $2,500 waffles a day, you need to slice a lot of berries.
Yeah, you had your work cut out for you. So was that the key difference, that the Belgian waffles were really light and the American waffles kind of doughy and heavy?
This Brussels waffle, the batter is very, very light. The batter, and I will not divulge our couple of our secret ingredients, but it's made from scratch, and till today I still make them the way my family has always done. The lighter the batter is, of course, the quicker it cooks once it touches the cast iron, and the cast iron heats up to 500 degrees. So the batter is seized so fast that it gets crispy on the outside, but inside still nice and soft. It's almost like air. Mm-hmm. People couldn't believe they could eat 2-3, you know, waffles, and that's because they're so light.
How much were these waffles selling for at the World's Fair when you first
99 cents. Yeah.
Why do you think Belgian waffles kind of became the waffle of the United States?
I guess because of the texture and the smell. The baby boomers still remember as a child going over to the World's Fair and smelling way, way, way away from us. The people were driven by the smell. And that was because of one of the ingredients we put in there.
What was the ingredient that gives off that smell?
We won't tell you.
Not vanilla, is it?
I can tell you many, but not the two. There's two ingredients. We'll not divulge.
Marie-Paul Vermeersch, whose family introduced the Belgian waffle in New York City in 1964. Marie-Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, and nice speaking with you. Bye-bye.
Oh, well, Marie-Paul's exact recipe will have to remain a mystery, but we found another tasty-looking Belgian waffle recipe that we can share with you. That's at PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Despite all the tensions that often crop up between the U.S. and China, English language proficiency is growing in China. And that's led to an interesting side effect. More and more Chinese, especially young Chinese, are giving themselves English names. Reporter Ruth Morris in Shanghai tells us about some of the names Chinese people are choosing for themselves and why.
Any foreigner in China has their own list of odd English names they've come across. There's Dell, who fixes computers. Tomorrow, a job applicant. There's also Cabbage, Box, Dream Jazz, Nothing, Eat, and Fancy Go-Go. Names say a lot about us when we get to choose them ourselves.
My Chinese name is Shi Zhi. My English name is Yes.
Yes is an actor. I asked him how he chose that name, and he said, one day,
I went to my American friend's party, and he asked me, oh, what's your name? I say, Shi Zhi. And he say, Shi Zhi? I say, yeah, something like that.
The Chinese word Shi means is. It's also used to mean yes. As a family name, it's pretty uncommon in China. So at the party, Shi told his American friend,
the Shi is like yes. Oh, so I just call you Yes.
He's been Yes ever since. Young Chinese people often adopt English language names to help out their foreign friends who struggle with the tones in Mandarin. It's like offering safe passage across a linguistic minefield. But that's not to say that all Chinese people embrace their English names.
I would never use my English name. I don't like it.
This is Gao Jian, who also went by James until 10 years ago. He teaches in the English department of Shanghai International Studies University. He says Chinese students started using English names in the 1990s when China was opening its doors to the world. People were really proud of their English proficiency.
We assumed that if we had a very good education in English, that it will secure a very highly paid job in the future.
But Gao thinks it's gone a little too far.
Sometimes we had a chat on some students. My colleague would say, oh, Rose told me, or Jack told me. I said, who's Rose, who's Jack? I don't know their English name. I hate that, frankly.
The names people are choosing are changing, too. Gao says more and more of his students are adopting names that sound like their given names or have a similar meaning, like Shi becomes Yes, or Lina might become Lina. Gao chalks this up to a deepening sense of national identity that takes pride in China's linguistic heritage. Still, there are plenty of people who draw on pop culture to name themselves.
In dreams you will lose your heartache. Whatever you wish for, you keep.
My English name is Cinderella, and my Chinese name is Liu Shuwen.
Cinderella is a marketing executive at a car company. The rags-to-riches motif seems especially fitting in a country that's just come through a 30-year economic growing spurt. But for this Cinderella, it's more about character.
I think Cinderella, she has a very strong heart, even in the very high pressure from her evil mother or her sisters. I think I can be like her, have a strong heart inside.
Are you looking for a prince?
Yes, I'm looking for a prince, but maybe not very rich, but it's my prince.
She's by no means the only Cinderella in China. There are some pretty normal names going around, too. Meet Yong Wei. He's a microbiologist. His English name is Tom.
I picked it back when I was in the middle school, and that's one of the few English characters I know from a cartoon, Tom and Jerry.
Okay, almost normal. Tom, of course, is the cat in the MGM animated series. I actually thought that was pretty original. Then I met...
My name is Jerry, Tom and Jerry, the Jerry. For one thing, you know, I have small eyes. That makes me like the Jerry in the cartoon. And for the other, you know, Jerry is always the naughty one, but always, you know, who wins the battle every time.
Jerry studied English and American literature at college. He had a classmate who went down a completely different road. He named himself Nixon. President Richard Nixon might conjure memories of Watergate in the United States, but in China, he's remembered for helping to normalize relations between China and the U.S.
My teachers, you know, back in college, they always wanted us to be the bridges between China and the Western countries. So he's a guy with a lot of ambition and passion for the cross-cultural communication.
Jerry says he's noticed a new trend. He's coming across more Westerners who are making a big effort to learn Chinese. A Dutch colleague recently made a point of learning and remembering Jerry's Chinese name.
When they really asked me about my Chinese name, I was kind of surprised. On my second thought, you know, it's a very cool thing, and it's equal.
Initially, Jerry adopted an English name because he wanted to look outwards and help build a bridge to the West. But now, he says, more and more Westerners are coming to China and meeting him halfway. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
And The World's language editor, Patrick Cox, joins me now. So you're working on a related story for tomorrow's show, right, Patrick?
Yeah, that's right. I am getting myself a Chinese name. In fact, I'm getting three Chinese names.
Why? One isn't good enough? Why you get three?
Well, you don't always get a name that you like or that you can use. Listen to this. This is writer Deborah Fallows. She told me about when she and her husband, James Fallows, they went to live in China a few years ago. They got themselves Chinese names. And typically, you get a name that in one way or another reflects something about who you are. So here's Deborah Fallows.
My husband is a small plane pilot. You know, I think he thinks of himself as a flyboy or something. It's very dashing. So they came up with a name that is Fei Jie, which means to fly or plane. And the Jie means something like very handsome and dashing. The whole thing kind of comes up to be flyboy. And whenever he uses his Chinese name, people just kind of cluck cluck and say, oh, great name, you know, great name. I had a much bigger problem myself because my name, Deborah, Deb, Debbie, any version of that just didn't work very well in Chinese. And the closest they could come up with was Jebby, which sounds kind of like Debbie, but what it means in Chinese is to borrow a pen. So I just felt ridiculous. You know, what's your name? My name is to borrow a pen. And I cast it aside. I never got name cards. I just failed in that part of the mission.
Boy, that sucks. Borrowed pen. Writer Deborah Fallows there. So, Patrick, the question for you is, do you get a dashing flyboy or a borrowed pen or maybe just a complete dog's dinner, a borrowed flyboy?
Tune in tomorrow.
Oh, no. The World's Patrick Cox, our language editor. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Yeah, you'll have to tune in tomorrow. That's our program today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We will be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.